Welcome to Project Chatter, the podcast where PPM experts from various sectors talk about the latest trends. Listen to Val and Dale as they talk about tried and tested best practices and share their unfiltered thoughts about the industry. Whether you're here to learn how to progress your career, improve your project control skills, or just want to hear an Aussie and South African rant about projects, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Project Chatter podcast with your hosts, Dale Fung and Val Matthews.
In today's economic climate, construction cost and schedule overruns can be disastrous.
Innate construction software helps you spot risks before they happen.
Their cloud-based solutions give you the real-time insights you need to minimize risk and improve operational efficiency.
With Innate, you keep projects on schedule and under budget. Get started today at innate.com. That's INEIGHT.com.
In this episode, we talk to Jesse Schilling and Colin McCrory about enhancing risk maturity in your operating environment. Let's get into Jesse first. Jesse combines creative and infrastructure intelligence. Jesse is a management consultant with HKA's advisory team, and at the core of her work are processes and people, where she seeks to implement agile strategies and solutions within complex project environments. Jesse is positioned in the integrated project services team, which specializes in risk management, change management, and portfolio alignment and performance, with a focus on process improvement.
Colin is a risk management professional with 25 years experience across many industry sectors and countries. He is the current and founding chair of the Institute of Risk Management Regional Group Australia and the trainer for the Institute of Risk Management training course in Australia. Outside of work, Colin likes to keep fit by boxing and doing cardio fitness. He's a family man and he's married with three children. Now, Val, we certainly went all over the show. It's not the first time we've, you know, spoken about risk and maturity, but it was interesting the angles that Colin and specifically Jesse brought to this episode.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've had some great risk people on the project, but it's always good to get a bit of an understanding of the importance of risk. Again, reminder that risk is, again, we talked about risk culture, which was fantastic. And then we slipped in there with a little bit of AI and talked about why AI could or maybe is adding value to risk.
Yeah, you love your AI, which is fantastic. I love the fact that you talk about AI and technology and the future, and yet your internet stops working again, which is great. But no, we had lots of interesting discussions with Jesse and Colin, and I think their views certainly will get the juices flowing, particularly on how those that find themselves at organizations or projects are looking for certain hints and tips to improve the risk culture, as you say, the maturity, the attitude towards risk. And there's some hints and tips that they give away. So look out for this one, folks. There's a lot to get your teeth into, but we'll leave it there. As we say, keep listening, keep liking, and keep paying it forward.
Hello, project people. Welcome back to a brand new episode of the Project Chatter podcast. It's always good to have you with us. And it's great to feel like we are a global podcast again, with people dotted all over the country and the world. And it's great to see you, Dale, taking some breaks out and a vacation. Where are you at the moment?
I'm in the Algarve, Val, trying to catch the last little bit of sunshine before we head into this UK winter. But the bigger question is, where's Martin Currison? Because he always gives you flack when you're not on. He always gives me flack when I'm not on. Have you seen him?
No, well, he did message me and said he's on a train to London. Slacker. So we will give him shit later, I'm sure. But it was actually our last podcast, or the last podcast, we were together. We were together in real time in Saudi, yep, which was fantastic. So I look forward to doing that in December, mate. You should come down for a little tickle in Saudi and we can do another podcast. But let's introduce our guests. First off, Colin, how are you, sir?
Well, thank you for having me on today.
Not a problem. I love having two guests because then we get twice the value. So I'm looking forward to hearing from you. And Jesse, how are you? You there, Jesse?
I did lose you for a moment, but I am here. Hello.
The only fallback is this internet connection sometimes does drop out, but don't worry, we will fix that. It's good to meet you guys. And so usually we get into this to just make it nice and easy, is a little bit about where you're from. And
the best thing is when Val's in Melbourne and it's raining and then the internet just drops out. We had that in, I think, 3 episodes ago, and it was fascinating listening to him talk over people while he didn't hear we were all talking, so it was great. But if we pick up from there while his internet rejoins, I guess if we start off, Colin, Jesse, you know, those that aren't familiar with you, the two of you, I don't know if you don't mind giving us a bit of a backdrop of, I guess, you know, how you started off, how you landed yourself in the project management space to the present day. And I guess as we, you know, say ladies first, so Jesse, if you don't mind going.
Absolutely. I think like any project professional, or more specifically a project controls professional, there's no linear journey. So for me, I first had an exposure to infrastructure through ARIP, and they had this vision of building a better world, and that really appealed to me. And so I found myself working for HKA, which works through end-to-end project lifecycle, and found myself looking at some of the project controls disciplines, change control and risk management, of course, which we're talking about today. And I now sit in a portfolio PMO role. So that covers portfolio alignment and performance, but also the robustness and maturity of our delivery methodology, particularly when it comes to project controls. So I really have a passion for linking those more conceptual to more tangible outcomes on our projects. And it's the place to be. Having this opportunity to inject some of the creative intelligence that I have to offer with the infrastructure intelligence that's required in the future. Amazing.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thanks. And, you know, those that do listen to the podcast, your name's actually no stranger to this podcast, because I think Simon White, probably about 2 years ago, name dropped you. He went to a conference you were talking at, and he said he loved your presentation. And I think you ended off with something like this, you know, there's probably only more questions and not no answers or something like that. So maybe we'll get into a bit of that as well. But Colin, let's bring you in. If you don't mind, I guess, sharing your backstory as well, your origin story and where you are today.
Okay. So my journey in the risk and the project management space started many, many years ago, like the start of a Star Wars film, you know. I was actually working as a contractor consultant for the Ministry of Defence over in the UK, and I had a tap on the shoulder one day, and it was a colonel, and he says, "Our risk manager just quit. We want to send you on a course, and then you can become our risk manager." So that's how my risk management life began. I went on a risk management course with in the military, and I weren't in the military. I was a civil person, you know, not in the military. I was a civil person, and I became their risk manager, and it was mainly for sort of defence estates at the time, and basically they looked after all the military establishments, all the CapEx works, all the OpEx works, and keeping the military moving and going somewhere for them for their squaddies to have a roof over their head type thing. So that's where I got into risk management there. From there, I went across and was working in the nuclear sector with the atomic weapons establishment, so still very much in the kind of like the military defense type space. And then after that, I jumped into transportation with London Underground, Network Rail in the UK. And then at that point, I had a company phone me up and say, "There's a big project going on in Australia, in Darwin, and we want you to come and help us do the risk management on that." So across to Perth I came. I was in Perth for a little while and going between Perth and Yokohama until I was mobilised up onto site in Darwin on the Ichthys project, which is a big $36 billion LNG plant that we built up there. Probably learnt my most about risk management there because I was working on the contractor side as opposed to the client side for once. So I got to see how things were done differently. And since then, after that finished, I've worked in government, I've worked, you name it, I've done it type thing. So I've worked in very many sectors, power, water, transportation infrastructure, the metros, all that type of stuff. And to a point where I've started my own risk management consultancy now called Victorum. We do risk management and CISA. And I've also become the founding chair of the Institute of Risk Management for the Regional Group of Australia, of which my good colleague there, Jesse, is also on the committee. So that's a bit of a life story there for you.
No, that's brilliant, Colin. And you got a lot of varied experience there as well. Myself and Val have also worked across various industries. But I think the thing that you got common with Val is you're both sort of from the military background. And one thing that Val's been battling with right now is his internet. So let's see if he's back on. You there, Val?
Yeah, hopefully you guys can hear me okay now. That's the life of Melbourne. There you go. You always get something special down here. Every time we press record, there's something happening here. Either I screw up the prompt, Colin, or the internet decides to drop me out when I'm talking. But look, I love the idea that that defense is your background, because I think one thing that defense do get right is rigidity and repeating the same practice over and over. And, you know, we can learn a lot in the public markets and sectors around how they actually build and develop projects. One of the challenges we do have...
And we've lost him again.
Can That's you guys great. Hear me?
He just said over and over, and there he goes.
I'll pause again.
You'll pause again. No, keep going. Back? You're back.
Yeah. Yes.
All right, good. One of the things we can learn from the defense industry is exactly that how they apply mature projects and approaches and guidelines and processes. But we don't see it a lot. Do you, with your background in defense, what's the comparison or the contrast between how defense run projects and how everyone else does?
Yeah, so when I was working in defense, I was working for defense states, so that's the infrastructure side of the military, and keeping that capability going in terms of their establishments. In that sense, it's probably somewhat different to the way that military operations run and stuff like that. So it was very much project management as we do it at a Sydney Metro or something like that. It was very much the similar type of... So I don't believe it was any... it was still quite immature, to be honest with you. I know I'm going back like 20, 25 years ago. So, but... the practices in the risk space was still quite immature. But again, that was on a different side of the military rather than you guys who was in the uniform. And, you know, you've got to be repeatable and you've got to make sure that those processes are rigid because, you know, lives depend on it in some instances, don't they? So it was very much different. But I did enjoy it. It was probably, if I was to say what was the best job I've ever had, that would have been it. You know, I just enjoyed the whole environment and working in, you know, as part of a kind of a mix military and civil team. And, you know, every lunchtime you could go out for a run without getting told off how long you're going to be and all this, because that was the environment you operated in. And it was great. I loved it. But it were to be for, you know, I just want my career just moved on and it was time to move on. And but I did learn a lot.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I think as well, we usually, when we bring in terminology, we always try and get a definition, because it's not necessarily because it's a hard word. It's because that word is used a lot. And risk is one of those words. And so is maturity. So I might just, to get a baseline, Jesse, maybe start with you and then Colin, maybe if you can also provide your definition. What is risk maturity? Just for the listeners. Jesse?
Yeah, definitely sure. So for risk management, I believe it's a bit of a dark. Some believe it's science, some believe it's more of the art side. However, risk therefore means, do we need to hypothesize if we take the science route, or if we take of it through the art route, do we need to think more conceptually about the interconnectedness of the risk landscape? So when we think of risk maturity, there's different lenses we need to have on maturity. Is it the maturity of the process, the maturity of the people, the data, or the systems? And we need a holistic view on what maturity looks like for risk management. in its essence, it's about pursuing that best practice and excellence and having continuous improvement in the risk management space. It's a measurement of ourselves, but specifically how we measure ourselves against best practice and continuously build maturity across projects, organizations, and industry at large, so that we can be fit for future as professionals.
Brilliant. And Colin?
Well, yeah, so Jesse's nailed it on the head there. But for me, in addition to that, I would say risk maturity is a way that we can understand how effective our risk management practices are and processes. And like Jesse's mentioned, people, everything. So it's all encompassing. Anything an organisation needs in terms of managing their risks effectively, and understanding where they are on a scale, and we'll take you through risk maturity models and how we can assess where we are on that scale shortly. But yeah, it's just a way of measuring the effect of your risk management.
I think the effectiveness is a really key word there, because in order to be effective, it's not just about being more advanced and optimized, it's also about having the basics right and having the fundamentals in place so that you can level up. Another element to it is, in order to be effective in risk management doesn't happen in isolation or in silos on a project. So you can't be effective in risk management if you're not also effective at holistic controls, your schedule management, your cost control, your change control, et cetera, et cetera. So effectiveness truly is a broader word in this context.
Yeah, those interconnectivities need to be there. One don't work without the other. It's a waste of time being good at something, and the next thing you need to do in the process just falls down. So it's a whole organisational thing. But in terms of the risk management, having that level of maturity is certainly going to stand you in good stead in achieving your objectives. And if we reference that back to a project, is achieving your projects on time, in cost, all that type of stuff. So
yeah, we've certainly heard it over the years that, you know, risk is important and we need risk on projects, and it is holistically part. And I believe I 100% agree with what you're saying. It goes along with planning. It goes along with project controls, good finance structures, everything like that. How come then, and this is a bit of a prodding question, because we're all in, three of us are in Australia. We've seen a lot in the news about project blowouts. This is no surprise, particularly on infrastructure and transport projects with massive amounts of funding going into those areas across the East Coast, where risk comes up as kind of almost like a lesson learned. Yet there was plenty of risk people on the projects. There was plenty of risk frameworks. There's no lack of risk process and methodology out there. What are we doing wrong, Colin? I might start with you.
Yeah, look, so I'll be blunt when I'm responding to this, because I'm a bit passionate about it, okay? So we've got good people, we've got good processes, we've got the frameworks, we've got everything. Unfortunately, I think there's a too much bias in the process. So, you know, the risk people, they're doing their thing, and they're doing it well. However, they can take it to a point, and then generally they're stopped at a point. I'm going to give you an example, okay? So risk management, everyone knows about contingency and how much you need to deliver a project and everything. The process should dictate how that contingency is derived. Okay, so you step through the process, you understand what your threats, what your opportunities, what your uncertainties, and you apply the amounts of money or the amounts of time around your base to achieve that contingency. Yeah, whether it's a P50, P90, whatever it is. Okay. There's been many occasions which I've witnessed, and unfortunately, more often than I'd like to remember, where you do that, you go through a process, you've worked hard, you've gone and you've got everything out, and then someone at the top, I know, a delivery director will say, make it 10 million or make it 20 million. There's a biased opinion, so the process then don't dictate what that contingency is. The bloke who's running the project tells you what it is. And that is the bias that I'm talking about. Now, that's one part of why I believe there's cost overruns, because taking a business case with the proper contingency that is required to deliver a mega project, you will never get the sign off because there's just not enough money. Yeah. So people take it forward with at the level that they can get the sign off. Yeah. And then worry about the rest of it later on. The other thing is I've spoke to many people about cost blowouts, and I'm going to call Inland Rail out because it's public and everyone knows it's cost blowout, and risk was one of the things that was the reason for it. A lot of people I've spoke to says it was always going to be that cost. That was always going to be the cost, or that's always should have been the cost to deliver this project. It's just that bias again. We can't go forward and tell everyone it was that cost because we'll never get it off the ground. So we'll tell them it's this cost, and then we'll add a bit, then we'll add a bit, and add a bit. And that's my honest opinion, and through speaking with people in industry and experts, of why there's a lot of cost blowouts. A, because there's bias in the process, and B, because, you know, maybe that was the cost of the project anyway, but we didn't want to tell everyone that because we'd never got it off the ground. So that's my honest opinion, sir, and that's backed on speaking with experts in the industry, sir.
Yeah, I'd love to get your take as well on that, Jesse.
It's very nuanced. I think what Colin has just touched on is there is that, I guess, top-down and bottom-up element to risk management where, you know, for our project environments, we want to ensure we're making the right decisions and decision-making, the leadership making decisions that aren't risk-informed. That might be influenced by the bottom up, or it might be top down. So if our risk information isn't being filtered up to the decision makers, or conversely, if the decision makers aren't willing to admit and face those risks, then there's a lack of transparency and ability to share that risk position, and then a lack of ability to be mature holistically. Another thing that I see on projects is that sometimes the risk profession and the risk manager isn't the voice of risk. Other project stakeholders can become the voice of risk. And so we have to be careful with how we interact, I think, with other project stakeholders in this space, in this day and age. Systems thinking is a huge element and complexity to our projects. And if we don't understand those interdependencies between different functions, and particularly when it comes to risk, complexity is a huge source of interface risks, as an example. And if we don't understand the complexity, we're not able to navigate that uncertainty. So, and the complexity. So it's an interesting space to be in this day and age, but it means that when we're getting a risk and we're doing the analysis, it's way more holistic than just a quantitative, say, like Colin said, like a quantitative number or contingency percentage that you can apply and fix. It becomes way more qualitative and interconnected to a lot of other elements of the project space.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, both of you. I mean, we're all project people, and I'm sure many listeners will resonate with what you're saying, particularly you, Colin, and Jesse, because risk, the torch of risk as well, I feel like sometimes the perception is it's a nice to have. And that's because it's not necessarily always embedded in the project. It's usually part of the what you call the PMO, or part of a kind of a professional service that sits on top of the organization, or next to the organization, or kind of next to the projects teams, which is unfortunate because obviously risk and the various other professional services like planning and cost control are all elements that help you to basically decide where you are and where you're going. And it's an unnecessary but necessary skill to have someone in that space that can champion and carry the torch for risk. And it's funny because I think a lot of project managers definitely do want that skill set. I don't think they're not wanting it. So there's this interesting dialogue between kind of what works on the ground, giving them value for money, and then at the top of an organization, how leadership maybe skews that bias, you said, Colin, in terms of how they adopt or adapt to risk. And as you said, maybe it's just a way to funnel money at a later stage and not necessarily scare people with a big cost. But I think there's some truth in that too. I'm going to bring Dale into the conversation because he's been very, very quiet. Dale, over to you.
I haven't been that quiet, Val. Whenever your internet breaks up, I jump in for you. But it's been fascinating listening to both you, Colin, and Jesse talk, because I was at a round table with the Infrastructure and Projects Authority the other day in the UK, and we were talking about, you know, various elements of how to measure all things. And it was interesting because we spoke about sort of politics making decisions on budgets and sort of burying their heads in the sand. And I think both of you alluded to that. And someone brought up the fact, I think it's in Ben Flivberg's book, that he writes about strategic misrepresentation, which is basically lying, right? So there is an argument to say that if you don't strategically misrepresent the full picture of your project and what it's going to cost, that you'll never get it signed off. But then on the other hand is how do you manage and mitigate that potential true cost? So that's an interesting aspect as well as my, I guess, my first observation. The other thing that I think you were alluding to, Jesse, was that, and if John Holman was on this episode, he's been on before, he would actually agree with you where you talk about, you know, risk being systemic, actually. And depending on the type of project, you know, whether it's, I guess, a bit of from Dave Snowden, whether it's a simple, chaotic or complex project, you'll have to apply different methodologies. And that's probably a good segue to go into those. But I guess my first question, Jesse, is risk management processes and methodologies, are they vanilla? Can they be vanilla? Or do we have to have them horses for courses?
It's a really good question, because I think when we think about ISO 31000 as an example, your textbook risk management, typically if you follow the process right, you could, you know, get away with ticking boxes. But I do think the real richness and beauty in risk management actually comes from, you know, customizing your approach to the project space that you're in. Like you've just said, we do operate on quite complex and large scale projects in this day and age. And that means that we have new requirements often. We have, you know, so sustainability requirements or regulatory requirements, which go beyond your usual PESL analysis. There needs to be crisis plans for black swan events like we've seen in the last couple of years. And a robust and mature culture will enable those things to not be surprises anymore. There'll always be an element of surprise, but I think when we have that nuanced understanding of how complex our projects are, we do live in a VUCA world, so volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous. And what that means is that our mitigations and our solutions actually also need to be complex and adaptive. If you think of when a project, as we've just said, say is announced, what happens in that timeline, whether it be 2 years, 5 years, 7 years, means that in their essence, a project is an intervention into a problem space. It's addressing a real problem. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a need for it. So how is that real problem and how's that problem space evolving as the project evolves? We need to adapt and evolve our risk management practices and our project practices at large to match and mirror the actual intervention we're trying to have in that problem space. So it becomes a much broader solution that we try to offer. And that really brings us to why we need to be effective in the type of risk management we do and truly robust and optimized in looking at, okay, lessons learned from past projects as an example, or leveraging if there's consistencies and similarities between some of these risks on our projects, why aren't we applying standardized treatment plans, say contamination as a perfect example, on our construction projects? How is there not a cookie cutter solution and mitigation that we're applying? Why are we reinventing the wheel every single time we encounter contamination on our projects? I'm obviously very passionate about this as well.
No, it's great points that you bring up there. And Colin, if I switch to you as well, and we kind of bring in some of the various, I guess, tools in the toolbox, you know, call them methodologies. Are there sort of simple ones you can apply to more simple projects versus the more complex ones? I mean, with complexity, we're looking at the likes of, you know, AI and ML coming in these days, big data, systemic risks require lots of various, you know, nodes and links to determine what the drivers are, the root causes, etc., and what the mitigations potentially are. Can we get into predictive analytics when it comes to risk and things like that? How big is the array of methodologies that are at the disposal of most project managers and risk professionals?
There's a lot there. So there's a lot of different methodologies we can apply. However, they all fit around the risk management process. So in the 25 years that I've been doing risk management across all those different industry sectors, I've used the same risk management process all the time. And what we need to do is continue to do the 31000 risk management process, but then we can support it with the innovative tools and techniques that are coming out now, the AIs and we did have a good Institute of Risk Management regional group. We did have a guy who talked about AI and how that's being applied in risk management, which is really interesting. Things are moving forward in the risk management space using those type of technologies and innovations. But there are a ream of tools, technology, techniques that we can apply depending on the size, scale, and complexity of a project. But it all fits around, at the heart of it is that risk management process. And as long as we stick with that as a core, we can apply all those different things around it, and we should be good to go. I believe one of the things that's impacting it most, Dale, is the time. And, you know, back in the day, again, I'm a bit of an older than you slot, we had time to deliver these projects. So we would work out what the time is to deliver a project. Now it's, we've got to get this project delivered before the next election. So everything's compressed, and that impacts what we can do in that risk space as well as every other part of the project. So, yeah, over to you. That's my take on it.
No, that's great. And sticking with processes, because you hammered down quite firmly there, it's, you know, process. And I just wonder, because, as you know, in different project environments, different organizations, you do get different, I guess, capabilities, skill sets, experiences, etc. And so should our processes be built around the knowledge, skills, and behaviors that are available to that specific project organization? Or should we develop processes and the knowledge, skills, and behaviors should formulate around the process? Which comes first, chicken or egg?
Yeah, so look, for me, the process is the process, and everyone should then, you know, fit around that process, and that should be at the heart of everything. And this is where this whole risk maturity discussion comes in. You know, different levels, different organizations will have, there's going to be different levels of risk maturity, and you know, from the naive through to the novice and the normal and the natural. So that's just a simple way of describing it. So when you've got an organization that's not got the capability, they've not got the training, they don't really understand anything, they haven't got the procedures in place, you know, we're talking that they're top of naive in what they do. Whereas someone who does, you know, they've got the risk culture there, they've got the people, it's embedded, the risk management is embedded in everything they do. They don't even have to think about it. It's just a natural thing. Yeah. They just do it because that's the way they do things. That's the other end of the scale. So from one corner to the other on a matrix, basically. And I believe that the processes still need to be at the heart of it, and all that needs to fit around it. And then we need to then develop the people, develop those procedures and all the tools and techniques to enhance that process. That's my feeling, and that's where I generally work, to be honest with you.
No, that's great, and it's good that you put your point of view across, because you clearly have a lot of experience in the space. And if I bring you back in, Jesse, just talking about, I guess, capability and training and maturity of organizations. I mean, Colin mentioned there are a few different levels of risk maturity in organizations. Do you perhaps mind, just for the listeners, decomposing what each of those levels look like in organizations? And then perhaps from there, what they may be able to do to go from the level they're at to the next level?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is truly Pandora's box when we start to get to that. So, yeah, heart is processes at the heart, like Colin has just said, but how we adopt that process and implement the process is really where we start to look at more of the problem space here. I think there's different maturity models out there, and it might be, depending on the size of your project or the scale of the industry that you're in, what model you adopt. So there's the three lines model, of course, line one, line two, line three. And arguably you need maturity at all three levels in order to be holistically mature. And this also introduces that complexity of assuring versus maturing in tandem, the assurance function and the risk management function. Of course, there's a P3M3 five-level maturity framework. I think this is what I've seen most commonly. So you're level one through to level five, you know, you're having more repeatable processes, practices to manage, to optimize. And that one's quite a simplistic and easy one to understand where you're at, because often you'll see, okay, well, do we have our practices documented as the first step? Do we have a risk management framework? Do we have a common language and consistent way we're identifying the cause and the effect and framing our credible scenarios as an example? And once you at least have that repeatable process, you can start to level up there where you get to your ideal state, which is when you're starting to optimize and you're starting to introduce AI. We have amazing AI capabilities now where we can actually get them to generate the scenarios and the solutions. And this will be the future. I don't want to scare any of our risk professionals, but Monte Carlo simulation isn't an optimization tool. So the future will be AI, which actually has that capability to optimize and not just predict and offer simulations. Those are a few examples of maturity models, but there's also the IRM has a maturity model. So they look at the four N's. So I think it's naive, novice, normal, and natural. There's other ones I've seen emerging, evolving. There's so many different ones which have beautiful buzzword languages, but essentially they're all trying to capture the same essence of different levels of maturity and capability in our organizations. And I think the first step there, I said it earlier in this podcast, was if you don't have the foundations right, you're not able to level up from there. Simple things like, are you conducting risk workshops regularly? But for me, it comes deeper than that. You might be ticking all the boxes and doing the risk reports and doing the risk workshops, but how are you engaging the stakeholders on the project? Are they actually contributing and engaged? So the other week we had an amazing 3-hour, don't recommend, risk workshop, which was a hybrid environment, which was very difficult. You had Miro boards with whiteboarding. You had 40 people in the room doing the old school post-it notes on your matrices, and you had to make it interactive. Otherwise you'd lose all of those project professionals and senior leaders in the room over a 3-hour period. So we had to bring risk to the forefront of culture and make it exciting and make it really an opportunity. It's not just a threat, it's a real opportunity. We wanted to think about how can we capitalize and exploit some of the cost-saving opportunities that we have on our projects, as an example. I'll pass to Colin if he has anything to add on the types of maturity models we see in the industry.
Yeah, so just following on from Jesse, and making risk management exciting is a hard job. So good work, Jesse. But yeah, look, there's a ream of risk maturity models. Everyone seems to have one these days. But essentially, what you need to use a risk maturity model to understand the effectiveness of risk management practices within your organization, and really what we do with risk maturity and the models that we use is kind of like you need to know where you are before you can decide where you're going. And I've done this quite a few times now. So as an example of how you assess your risk maturity, you've got your risk maturity model, you've got a big list of questions, and you basically sit down with all levels of the hierarchy through an organization, from the top of the board all the way through to the graduate. It's just walked through the door and, you know, it's a bit green. And you ask these questions and you get their inputs, and then that goes into the model, and hey, presto, outcomes. You're a level 2 or you're level 3, depending if it's a 4 or a 5 or a 6 kind of level model. Okay. And then when you've spoke with the board, as well as asking them these interview questions, you're asking them, as an organization, where do you want your maturity to be? And, you know, we shouldn't all assume that maturity needs to be at the highest level. The maturity needs to be where it needs to be for whatever your organization is doing, you know, what your ambitions are and what your goals and your objectives are. So you don't always have to have the top scale of maturity. It's got to be appropriate for your organization. So we understand where the board would want you to be, where you currently are, and then you've got that, put that roadmap in place, and then you can step through what are the things that have came out that's low as part of that model, that assessment, and that you need to work on to help you get up to where you want to be, and what are the things you're doing good now, can you enhance them even further, and that's basically how you do it. But I will say, I've done some of these, and one of the ones I did was over for the Northern Territory Government, specifically on the power and water side of things. And it just to get one step in that maturity matrix and that model was kind of like a two-year roadmap. You know, it's not an overnight. You can't just go from A to Z quickly. It's like risk culture. It's not an overnight thing. You know, it's everyone talks about it. To actually get it embedded and be working effectively in your organization, it takes years. And so I would say to all those organizations out there that, you know, do want to start enhancing their risk maturity, you know, get started now, because it's not a 5-minute job.
Yeah, that's great, Colin. I was actually thinking when you said risk culture, that was exactly the question that I was going to talk about, was that bit like safety, you know, health and safety and quality. I mean, it's everybody's responsibility on a project to make sure that they're involved in it. And changing culture is absolutely one of the hardest things to do, because that's hearts and minds stuff. And to borrow the cigarette marketing campaign philosophy, get them while they're young. How do we get young people involved? Because obviously these projects now, we're looking at 3 generations of people, of workers in the same space, working in the same time with different ideas about how projects are run. You got the old school, you got the middle school, and you got the new school. How do we get the new school into risk and make it exciting, as Jesse's doing a great job, obviously, but how do we do that, Colin? And then I'll jump to Jesse.
Yeah. Okay. So you're right. So, I mean, looking at this screen now, I'm guessing I'm in the old school and Jesse's in the new generation, and you guys are somewhere in between, eh? But look, what we've done, we've formed the Institute of Risk Management Regional Group for Australia. And I'm the chair of that, and Jesse's one of the committee members, along with Nathan and Anne. Shout out to those guys. And one of the purposes of forming that group is obviously we want to bring the Art Institute Risk Management members together, and obviously to network. But the second part of that is, A, we want to help increase the risk maturity throughout this great nation of Australia. But we also want to start developing that next generation of risk professionals, because, you know, I'm not going to be around forever, and Jesse's going to move up the hierarchy. So we need to consistently bring in that next gen. And that's one of the ways that me, Jesse, and the team are actually actively working on bringing that next generation in, making sure that when they do come into the market, and, you know, with the innovation things that Jesse talked about in those workshops, making risk not a boring subject, making it a bit more fun, a bit more innovative, and that type of stuff. Making sure that when they come into the market, the Institute of Risk Management and the Risk Management Institute of Australia, they're aware of those places, the training courses they can do, how they can develop their career and all that, and just basically giving them that mentoring and that encouragement. So that's something that we're actively doing right now. And Jesse, do you want to add anything further to that about what we're doing as part of that group?
I think what I'll add is, I guess on that, yeah, how do you make that intergenerational connection in the industry? I think this is a perfect case study because Colin and I worked together in my first couple of years in infrastructure industry. So worked side by side doing risk management. And so I was learning from him, and we were working across 6 of the Greenfield City stations on a metro project. And that truly exposed me to risk management. Before that, I actually had no idea it was a profession. And it's an interesting concept because in schools these days, kids are being told that the jobs that they might be applying for in the future don't exist yet, and that the skills that they need might not be known yet. Then us in industry are being told that we may be made extinct by AI. But really what we're starting to see is that there's a lot of really niche professions out there. And if you don't have exposure or understanding of them, how are you meant to know that that could be a good fit for you? And so I was really, inspired by how Colin and how the project teams really rallied around risk management. And that's what brought me in. And I think that's how we'll bring in other generations, is too, by pure exposure. If someone's analytical, it's a perfect pathway, but also there's a lot of creativity and innovation opportunities in this. My concern, I will caveat, is I do think it is too easy in this day and age to become a risk manager. There are a lot of qualifications that are available out there, but if you don't have that depth of experience and ability to actually manage risks on projects, that's truly what will differentiate you as a risk manager. I have seen it, and Colin, we had a conversation about this. We have seen project resources being progressed very early on in their careers, purely maybe because of the skills shortage and resource constraints that we have across the market. but they don't have that depth of maturity. And that might be why we're seeing a lack of risk maturity across our projects in Australia.
Yeah, there's good points there, Jesse and Colin. I just wonder, though, and this might be me being a little bit provocative on the Project Chatter podcast, have we done risk management on projects a disservice by giving it a function and a name and a role and a title as risk manager? Because often you get on some projects that are more immature, and it's not my job. It's the risk manager's job. So have we done it a disservice by sectioning it off, by siloing it? Colin, let's hear from you first.
Yeah, I'll go with that one. Yeah, you're probably right, because, you know, if we go back to, Jesse mentioned the three lines model there. The first line of defense is for everyone on the project who's actively working on a project. These should be actively thinking about risk, considering risk, and remember, risk is threat and opportunity, and managing risk. And then the risk manager is meant to come in as that second line, and then make sure that the first line is doing what they've obviously helped guide and assist, but also make sure that they've thought about everything, they're being proactive. And so by bringing in a risk manager, there is the culture that it's not my job, that's a risk manager's job to do it. And that is incorrect. And this is where the risk maturity and the understanding of risk needs to be better. It is the frontline people, the project managers, the project teams who should be actively managing their risk with the support of the risk manager. It ain't the risk manager's jobs to do the management of risk. It's to make sure, help guide and assist with the management of risk. So there may be some disservice there. Yes, I would agree. Yeah,
it's an interesting one, because project controls or PMO, whatever you want to label it, right? We have all these different, I guess, functions, if you will, you know, and sometimes I think we've distilled it too much and we forget that actually it's actually a small part of a whole, and we forget that actually, you know, the moving parts have to move together in synchronization. And Jesse, if I bring you back in, I just wonder, do you have any real life examples where you've seen this type of culture and behavior, and how potentially that project or organization has managed to change their risk culture around?
Yeah, of course. So I think this conversation is interesting, because without someone facilitating and driving risk and being a champion for it, I think it often gets pushed in the corner, or it becomes more of that auditing function. What I've seen is that ownership and accountability in this space is really important. So as an example, if you have your risk register for one component of your project, so say a contract package, you'll often have your delivery director maybe who manages most of those risks, but the people that are actually responsible for implementing some of the treatments and the mitigations and controls will be your project team members. And I think this is where we start to see more of the relationship to the projects is who's owning this, who's ultimately accountable if something goes wrong here, or if it's realised, versus who actually has the power to intervene and to help be a part of the solution and treatment here. And that's where we start to see an improvement in the holistic culture, is everyone realises they have a part to play in mitigating risk on the project, or exploiting it in the opportunities environment. I don't want to ever neglect the fact that it is the positive and the negative sides of the risk management. So I think risk ownership is probably the best example. That's something that came out of the workshop that we did the other week. The project director stood up and said, you know what, I don't want to walk away with any actions from this risk workshop, because while he wants the oversight of all of the risks, he wants his team members to be taking accountability for the mitigation strategies that they're putting in place and to run with them and to just report back. So hopefully that's a good example.
That's encouraging to hear that a project delivery director is saying that. So that's good.
I was just going to add there as well, Jesse, with regards to mitigations and treatments. I mean, what that director said was fantastic, that don't take actions, you know, because one of the challenges with risk I see is the risks are raised. I think everyone does a good job at raising risks. They're like, hey, this could be an issue, or this could happen. Then from there, something happens between that and the treatment of the risk. Now, I'm not sure on the projects you've been on, but the projects I've been on, mitigations tend to become then a secondary habit of ignorance, and they just kind of like, oh, well, I've done the risk, you know, tick for me. And then I see a lot of risk managers running around trying to get the real value, which is let's avoid this risk or whatever the treatment might be, or let's mitigate this risk and let's get a treatment plan in place or a mitigation plan in place and let's do that. How do you deal with the whole mitigation process? And is there a way for people out there listening to, you know, get more accountability? Because that was another good point you raised around the treatment of risks rather than just raising risks. I'll go with you first, Jesse.
So I think it's interesting when we talk about risk mitigations and treatments, it really stems from having a good understanding of root causes. So that detailed understanding of causation then enables us to have credible scenarios and be treating both cause and effect. I think we need to be really careful in this space that we're not just treating or considering the consequence, but also trying to get to the systemic root cause of these risks and those underlying drivers. So having a robust understanding of the risk environment and the risk profile and a comprehensive analysis behind the risk really drives a mature mitigation plan. So as an example, say in a defense context, this is where we started with the project podcast. So it's a good place to come back to. In the defense landscape, there is quite a difference in the types of impacts and the also the objectives that they have as, say, compared to a construction site. So in both of these industries, you need to have a mature understanding of the safety element when it comes to your risk profiles, but you might also then have a different appetite in how you tolerate those risks. So in a defence landscape, often there's stable risks that must be managed on an ongoing basis to ensure that there's a certain level of preparedness for certain risk events. And what you'll see is that there's often these enduring long-term risks, right? And so because of the length of the duration we've held these risks, what we'll see over time is we start to become more mature in our understanding of that risk and our assessment of the best controls and mitigations. And I think that's important to note is that we can't be static or stagnant in the types of controls and mitigations, because if it is a long enduring risk that we've held, we need to constantly thinking about how to optimize the mitigations and interventions that we're making. Another good example to think about in this context is maturity for mitigation in this sense looks different based on the exposure. So we might have a certain risk event that we are prepared for, but if we go into a different operational environment, we might actually have a different exposure to that. And that requires a different level of mitigation depending on what materials and that operational environment provides us, the support that we have there to actually successfully treat it. Hopefully that's a good example for you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, with regards to, you know, most projects, you know, problems start with people, not necessarily the project itself. I mean, most projects, to be fair, if it didn't have people involved, would run pretty well. But the complexity comes in when you've got projects and people with personalities starting to deliver these projects, and the dynamics between those can get a bit muddled. And obviously, you know, it's busy, as you said, Colin. I think you mentioned, you know, projects, we just want to get them done now. The speed and the validity and the, I guess, you said VUCA, Jesse, you know, it's all there because these projects now, they're not small projects. We're not necessarily doing projects. We're effectively doing programs, if we're going to be honest, or portfolio level kind of massive pieces of work across various pieces of landscape, sometimes mixed technologies as well. Rail always has a problem with this, especially because it does involve technology, software, as well as infrastructure. A question, if I don't bring this question up, I guess my listeners will hate me, because I'm very for the future. I'm a big adopter of the tech. And I've been talking about AI for years before it got popular. You know, it's kind of like chefs, then chefs went to master chefs, and then now all chefs are celebrity chefs. I feel like project people are getting their limelight now, and particularly because of the attractiveness and the possibility of what AI and smart tech could do for our industry, massively disrupting it in a positive way. Obviously, we don't have enough people, so we do have skills constraints and shortages, but there's also a way to reinvent some of these sectors and industries and disciplines. And I think as as someone really close to the ground on this, I think risk is right up there as one of the first to really adopt and take advantage of AI. Now, that's my personal opinion and preference, but I'd love to hear, maybe Jesse, you first, and then over to you, Colin. Jesse, what do you think about AI?
It's an interesting question because in personal life, I'd have a different response to, say, professional life. I think there's a huge opportunity when it comes to risk management, I agree, and the project profession at large. In my personal life, I'm a creative writer. So to me, there's a huge, threat in the sense that I like to take pride in, actually writing every word and conceptualizing that and claiming it as my own. My pet peeve is reading CVs or reading reports, and you'll see fiscal mentioned about 10 times and you're like, ChatGPT has been used here. So that to me is really frustrating because we cannot let AI actually remove our own cognitive reasoning and emotion and the value that we can actually give to certain dialogues in society. So when it comes to risk maturity and risk management, AI is a huge opportunity in space. There's certain AI models where they operate within constraint resolutions. So you have your engineer and your project planner up front who set the parameters and the rules for that AI model. And those rules and parameters might be hard logic in the form of calendars. They might be material and labor constraints. And then that AI model then goes and runs millions of simulations for different construction sequencing and how to optimize. You can choose whether by duration, by cost, whatever you would prefer aligned to your project objectives. And what we see is that AI doesn't omit us from the process. It actually invites us to both manage and innovate in the project environment. So we're able to optimize. And I think it's a real advantage for us because we can actually start to see our credible scenarios play out and how we can enact different mitigations. So say we have opportunity to accelerate, we might be able to add in extra resources, or it might actually be more effective to introduce new labor and materials into the construction process. And then suddenly you can see how that affects the rest of the construction sequencing and then optimize from there. It's going to be a more fluid future, I think, when we start to actually see this in practice on our projects. But what we really need is our project environments to champion this and to have this tool available to project professionals at large. It can't be one single functional professional on the project who is advocating for it. It needs to be seamlessly integrated with the entire project.
Yeah, definitely. Colin, what do you think?
I'm old school, aren't I? So AI's, but I had a chat yesterday with a guy called Quan Quang, if you ever met him. His company is called Optum AI. And he was actually the keynote speaker at the Institute of Risk Management networking event. And that opened my eyes to AI, and in particular to AI in the risk management space. One thing he has said is it's not going to get rid of the people. Don't panic. So there is a need still for the risk management professional. Like Jesse said, we're going to still be involved. And it's just, I think with the amount of data that's available in the risk management space, applying the AI to it, it can only come up with advantages rather than disadvantages. We just need, in my mind, to make sure that we, I don't think we should be, again, like this maturity steps, I don't think it'd be an overnight thing. And I think people will probably try and push it. I personally would rather just take it a little step at a time. And I know technology and innovation don't wait for anyone, but to make sure that when we are using AI in the risk management space, we're using it correctly. It's supporting that maturity levels that we need it to support. But I certainly do see that as a future, having had a lot of interaction now with Quang on the AI space and risk management. So, it's coming, and it's coming fast. So you'll be using AI in risk management probably in the next year or two, I guarantee it,
100%. I think you said something really...
One thing he did say, I'll just finish off on that. One thing he did say to me is they're currently working on, interfacing or interacting or connecting with other softwares that work in the risk management space. So, like we use risk management information systems, and some of those might be Cura or Active Risk Manager. And then we've got the at risk for the quantitative and those type of systems. Then AI are now starting to look and work how they can interact and connect with those, so the whole process can be linked. So it's definitely getting interested in that space for sure.
Yeah, and you pointed out a really important factor for everybody listening. If you are in the risk space, AI is not coming for your jobs, ladies and gentlemen. I don't think that is even a remote possibility, because we still need. And I actually think, Jesse, your creative point. What will happen is we'll get a lot more creative in terms of how we plan and scenario base and how we utilize AI to help us kind of predict various different pathways the project potentially could go down. And risk is kind of at the forefront of that. And I've had a lot of conversations in Sosdale with lots of people from around the world, project professionals, and their take on AI. So I always ask that question just to get a view, even if you're old school, Colin, that's okay. You know, this is coming for everybody. And I think one of the great things about it is it's opening the barrier of resistance. So the barrier of entry to kind of access systems and enterprise tools used to be you had to be proficient. You had to know how the tools work. I mean, we have the same conversation with Primavera P6. You know, unless you kind of know your way around the tool, it's pretty useless to you. Same with some of the risk tools. And if you're doing QRA or QSRAs, it can get pretty overwhelming. The value that AI will bring is that simplified interface where you won't need to know how it works. So very similar to our smartphones. We don't necessarily know how they all work, but we know that they're simple and they do what we ask them to do. So I see it as kind of this, and I think Microsoft stole the word, but co-pilot, or, you know, your wingman or wingwoman to help you, support you as an assistant rather than driving the program. And I do believe there is some ethical dilemmas, Jesse, around people abusing it, but that's just normal human nature. I think when we get something of massive power, we do something naughty with it first, and we're like, oh God, we're going to have to put some regulation around this because there's too many cowboys out there or cowgirls. So we're going to have to get to a point where we regulate AI. That's absolutely going to happen. But one of the things I spoke to Dan Patterson about on a podcast not too long ago was that maybe software is absolved completely and you start with a blank canvas with this huge large language model in the background that can access anything you want, from benchmarks to inherent kind of risks to project canvases and how you might lay out the project to the types of project teams you might want to the organizational design, and effectively does it based on prompting, you know, the key leadership team on what kind of project they want to set up, what kind of budget they have, what kind of risks they were happy to accept. That is not too far away with existing technology. That's how excited I am about that. But I want to know, from your perspective, you know, what would a great risk tool look like if it had an AI-capable background or system? Is there such a thing as like the perfect AI application? You know, you're not going to offend any software companies for me because I don't really care. But from your perspective, what do you think a really good AI product might feel or look like for our listeners? Jesse, I'll go with you first.
So I'm very solution-oriented, and I think us on projects and risk community at large should also be solution oriented. So for me, it's important to differentiate the quantitative and the qualitative element of risk management, and therefore that dictates what we would need from AI. So I do think there's a huge potential in the quantitative realm for AI to be involved and to help us spit out different millions of simulations that we can optimize, like I mentioned before. But then when it comes to the qualitative, I think there will still be a large degree of human interface with our project stakeholders and different functional teams across projects. But how we bring in AI to that qualitative space is really the question here. Like, there'll be opportunities to do the scenario modeling, but where we have the opportunity, if they're able to help us understand the context better or identify the risks better, that's going to be an interesting space if that's able to be possible. I'd like to see that be an even balance of AI helping us in the qualitative and quantitative realm.
Yeah, brilliant. Colin?
For me, a perfect AI tool in the space of risk management is going to help. In my mind, there's a lot of data available and sifting through that data. So we all do these lessons learned. But then we all go and, like Jesse mentioned earlier, contamination, we reinvent the wheel every time we do it. I think this is where AI can really help us. Instead of reinventing the wheel, the data's there, the AI can identify it, what worked, what didn't work, all that type of stuff. But in order for that to happen, I think we need to not just the risk management process and the data, but we also need to feed into that system what went well, do the lessons learned bit, and feed that back into there. So when it's doing its whatever it does in AI, it's considering what went good, what didn't go good. Hey, that control worked, that one didn't. I'm not going to pull that control that didn't work back in there. So that's the way I'd see a good AI tool, and I don't know anything about AI, I've got to be honest with you, right? So on the technical side of it. But for me, risk manager, if I've got a system that can give me the good things that happened and I can reapply them and keep the bad things and save us time and effort on things that don't work in the background, that would be my perfect tool.
You've just made me realize, Colin, what I do think will be ideal if AI can do this is if we can optimize and have that optioneering up front end, like you've kind of explained, Aval, with the opportunity in project inception space, but then with that mitigation space, if AI is also able to provide us that optioneering and to even give us, you know, red, amber, greens or percentage-based effectiveness. If they can predict the effectiveness of that control, that will help us to be able to select the correct control based on our desired end result for treatment. Maybe we want to transfer it so we're not actually super concerned about the level of how we're controlling it versus if we are the ones actually mitigating it. That would be an amazing feature to have, I think, in the future.
Yeah, it absolutely will. And, you know, I was smiling that, and if you saw Jesse and Colin when Val was sort of, you know, losing himself in the AI. He loves the space. I mean, if you listen back to sort of some of our first episodes, he spoke about Elon Musk every single episode, and I think he's probably got the chip in the back of his head. But no, it's great that I think we muse, we kick the tires on what technology can give us. But I think where I am with this is based on what you're both saying is that it's not just technology, it's not just processes, it's people, it's attitudes, behaviors, it's systems, it's the environment, it's the sector, the type of project, the novel uniqueness of that specific project that makes it different, that gives it, you know, all of its risk and all of its threats and all of its opportunities. And so it's quite interesting from that perspective. And the question that I had in my mind for, I guess, both of you was, have you ever worked on a project where there was a particularly high percentage of mitigation actions that actually mitigated threats? And if so, what was that percentage and what was that project or organization doing specifically? Well, let's start with you, Colin.
Yeah, so if I was going to call out a particular project, and I won't remember the names because it's been quite some time since I worked on a project that mitigated all these risks, to be honest with you, Dale. It was in the rail space back in the UK, working for Network Rail and working for a part of that where we was doing, like, you know, obviously going out on weekends and replacing it, whether it be a bridge or a bit of track or, you know, whatever it was. Because there was consistent practices, they kind of like knew the type of risk they would face. They knew the mitigations that they could apply and which ones were effective and which ones wouldn't. But that is because they've been doing it for years and years and years. And a bit like that rigidity that Val mentioned with the defence, they had that type of consistency. So in that rail space in the UK, I would say, and this was across many different projects, not just one, that's where I don't know what the percentage was, mate, but I'd say probably 75% of the, I'll call out 75% of the risks that we captured and we had in the risk register were probably mitigated in full, and the remaining 25, which, you know, provided us that residual risk after we put our controls and treatments in place, were at a level that was within the majority of the case. We were in the level that was within the risk appetite tolerance to move forward and deliver that job. I will note that any risks that weren't, that did fall outside the appetite tolerance, and that might have been when we did our quantitative, we did some quantitative modelling if it didn't fall within a certain appetite tolerance, which we had to work within, that project didn't go forward that weekend. Yeah, so, you know, we didn't replace the bridge. We didn't replace the track. So because it was all about that rail, that train needs to come down there 6 o'clock Monday morning to take the commuters into work. And if we couldn't finish and get that project back ready for that train, first train, we can't do it. Yeah, so having effective mitigations and controls in place to ensure that that first train runs on Monday morning, take the commuters down to London or wherever they were going. That's my example, Dale, of effective risk management, mitigations, controls, treatments.
That's brilliant. There's nothing like working on a live operational railway, right? Mm. When there's engineering closure, it's or position.
That's it, yeah, engineering works, yeah.
Yeah, it's great. It takes me back to my TFL days as well. But Jesse, is there anything particularly that stood out for you in working on various projects that, you know, they did particularly well, you know, for those listening to go, this is what we did particularly well, and we managed to have a great mitigation strategy, actions, tactics around ensuring that our risk didn't get out of hand?
I think the first thing that comes to mind is that interface I mentioned earlier with change control. Since having worked in the change control space, you can imagine that that is seeing some of the realization of our risks. So what's important throughout the early identification of emerging changes, emerging risks, is to also be understanding the potential impacts in that space. So as a part of your change control process, having a robust change impact assessment process that has risk fundamental to all of those impact assessments is really critical. And that's where you can have a good intervention. You want to move essentially to that proactive space rather than that reactive space. And I think that's where I see a lot of opportunity. I haven't seen it necessarily done well, but to really inject that learning, like we've mentioned before, the proactive lessons management into being the proactive risk management is a huge opportunity space. And I think that will be what all organizations and projects will need to be successfully mitigating in the future. That's more of an anecdote rather than deliberate examples.
No, it's great. It's great because I think, you know, if you combine what you and Colin are saying there, I think, and, you know, based off the last topic you were talking to Val about around AI, I think this is where ML and AI can help with lessons learned and, you know, planning for mitigations as well. Because if we go into the simulation space that you talk about, Jesse, you know, if you simulated, you know, the top 10 different scenarios that could happen, you'd know if a certain event happened that delayed you or caused you to overrun, whatever the case might be, you have a backup plan immediately. You know what the mitigation is. Potentially, you get that with the right experience in the room, but we all know that experience across the globe is in short supply. So I think it's a tough ask, but I think certainly one that we should definitely get you guys back to explore on, because I think from a technology perspective, and particularly in risk management, AI ML is just at the starting point. It's the tip of the iceberg. So yeah, we'd definitely love to have you guys back. But, you know, the hour has gone so fast. There's so much we probably want to cover with you on the next time. However, before we let you go, heading in towards the end of the pod, I want to know, I'll go to you first, Colin. Are there any final thoughts that you want to leave our listeners with?
Yeah, look, I would like to say that, you know, risk management is an important part of project delivery and the whole project life cycle. And, you know, a risk manager or risk professional, as most of the project controls, they need to be across every part of the project. So, you know, they do have the knowledge, they do have the experience in most cases, and they should have a voice when they're out there and they're supporting you guys and girls in that project delivery. So just bear that in mind. Give them a rough ride all the time, and you know, listen to what they've got to say, because risk management does provide value when used properly. For those people at the top, you know, the tone at the top is important. Without that, your whole organization's risk is not going to be embedded and where it needs to be to support your objectives and give you the successes that you drive to achieve. But I'm very passionate about risk management, as you can probably tell. And I would like to say, if anyone would like to know more about risk management, as I've mentioned a couple of times, Institute of Risk Management Region Group for Australia. If you want to come along and join one of our, like we do about every 6 weeks, a networking event or chat like this online, and every so often we do a networking event, please reach out to either myself or Jesse, and we can give you the details. And that includes you two gents as well, if you fancy.
Brilliant.
Good discussions.
Awesome.
No, absolutely. And hopefully Val's internet is working better next time. And, you know, the thing is, I think, I was going to say anyway, you know, they could reach out to you. But what you need to do for us, Colin and Jesse, is send us all of the links and how to get in touch, and we'll add it to the show notes so everyone can get on those links as well. But Jesse, your final thoughts?
I think my call to action is, as Colin's just alluded, there's a lot of industries and different sectors that implement risk management practices in different ways, and we should be learning from each other. We should be proactive and learning on not just on our projects, but across different industry sectors. I'm a huge advocate for that, in translating different solutions and interventions into problem spaces into our own space. So having safe to fail experiments, encouraging, not stifling innovation. And for the risk managers, the real call to action is to be champions of those solution oriented, I guess, conversations on your projects, and to also really be a bridge between how we understand complexity and how we navigate complexity in this VUCA world.
I love it. It's changing the narrative from, oh, here comes the risk manager, to, oh, here comes the risk manager. Great. Anyway, it's been such a pleasure. You're here to help. Exactly. You're here to help. It's been a pleasure having both of you. Let's see if Val gives us his final thoughts, if he can hear us.
Well, look, if you can't believe it or not, we did talk about risk for over an hour easily, and I'm sure we could have spoken for a lot more if we wanted to. But Jesse, Colin, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on. And we look forward to joining some of your networking events and webinars, and we wish you well. And thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
No, thank you both. It's been our pleasure, and it wouldn't have been a Project Chatter podcast without some technical glitches, but I think Val's going to get straight on the line to Elon Musk to sort it out. But there you have it, folks. That is the end of this episode. Please do help us pay it forward and share a link to this episode on your favorite social media. Once again, a massive thank you to Colin McCrory and Jesse Schilling for giving up their time. And thank you all for listening. Till next time, we say stay safe, be disruptive, and have fun doing it. From me and Val, it's bye for now.
For more information, blogs, or to support our charities, visit projectchatterpodcast.com. And if you would like to sponsor the podcast, get in touch via our website.
You can also leave us a voice message via our anchor page and let us know if there's something or someone specific that you would like on the podcast.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the participating individuals and not necessarily to the individual's employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual. Additionally, any views or opinions are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, or individual.